All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and here we are in Studio A110 in Salt Lake City with another beautiful studio audience. There are those that predicted our demise, and we are going strong. I checked the statistics today for the month of May, and we had 100,000 downloads in May, which is 10% boost over our highest month previously, which is great. About 50% of our downloads are accounted for by the last 10 podcasts. So, you know, so the question, because a lot of people binge on the podcast. I get this a lot, that they'll start listening, and they listen and listen, 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 listen. So that indicates there's a lot of new listeners. And last I checked, in the first 24 hours after we post a podcast, we'll have 5,000 downloads, which is an enormous spike. So I'm pleased to see that it's still growing and people are listening. I was joking around on Facebook today. Well, it wasn't a joke. When we first set up the podcast, we thought, well, if we get 1,000 people to listen, we'll be successful. And I don't know how many tens of thousands have listened, but you guys are out there, so I appreciate every one of you who listens. Thank you very much. In the news, well, first of all, our lovely panelist. First of all, to my left in the co-pilot's chair is Adam. Hey, Adam.
Hey, everyone.
Adam,
glad to be here, John.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm born and raised in Salt Lake. Married, I'm 33 years old, got 4 kids, and love the show. Avid listener, first time panelist.
Welcome. It's kind of a. Are you nervous?
You know, I'm sitting. I have a confession to make.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here, and my hands feeling moist and clammy, and
you never go wrong with the word moist, well, by the way.
Yeah, it's a fantastic word, and Perry put out the message looking for someone to be on the panel, and one of my friends sent it to me, and they said that it was on Plato and Mormonism, and then I saw the T in there, and I feel terribly underwhelmed that it's Plato and Mormonism, so I'm just hoping, you know, going back to my Mormon roots, that the Spirit will be with me today, and I'm very ill-prepared.
Me too. All right, Hillary.
Hi, John. Hi, everyone.
Is it that you've been on before, right, Hillary?
Yes.
Welcome, Hillary.
A couple times.
Hillary has recently agreed to come on. She's helping coordinate our events in Salt Lake City, and she's been doing a bang-up job so far. So thanks, Hillary. I'm happy to be working with you.
I'm really excited.
Yeah, we're getting a popcorn machine.
For we later. Are.
I don't want to make everybody out there in New Zealand jealous.
So come watch live. We'll have popcorn.
Yeah, by the time this airs, it'll be in the past. But there'll be things in the future with popcorn. So
can't go wrong with popcorn.
We're big time here. It's not just like skunky 3-2 beer. It's also popcorn.
And decaf coffee.
I'm actually drinking tea today. I do usually drink decaf. Otherwise, I stay up all night. All right. Anything else that you guys don't care about hearing about? All right, let's get started with the news. As always, we lead with the stories from the last week. Two big news stories in the state of Utah. First of all, and I always love it to see which news stories out of Utah and out of the church hit the big news, hit the national news. And you should all know. People say, why does the rest of the world view Utah as weird? If you live anywhere else in the country, the rest of the country views pretty much the rest of the country as weird. And there's these stories coming out of every state. If you've been anywhere in the South or in the Northeast, or there's strange people all over. So don't take it too hard when we make fun of Utah here. There was a yearbook. I didn't write down.
Wasatch
County. And for those who are uninformed, where the hell is Wasatch County?
Up in Heber, isn't it? Yeah.
Okay.
Heber area.
So, yeah, you go over the mountain. So if you're going to come to Salt Lake, you know, oh, there's the beautiful mountains to the east, and there are all the ski resorts. And then you go over the mountain. There's a great, you know, city with lots of stars and starlets. And then you keep going about another 20 miles, and you hit Heber. And so it's kind of a little backwoodsy, but not too much. Well, so there were several young women in the yearbook who were wearing tank tops, sleeveless paraphernalia.
Harlots.
And the principal apparently commissioned the photographer to Photoshop in coverings for their shoulders. Now, this is Mormons have changed, by the way. I'm 41, and when I was a child, this was not an issue. We didn't, at least not, was it in Utah County? Anybody my age from Utah County? Because Utah County is the, like, fucked art center of Mormonism. Well, is that not a real word? Oh, there you go. In the old days, were they still, because they were still enforcing garment standards for kids? Oh, okay. Because when I was up in Weber County, you know, Ogden and the railroad and the prostitutes and stuff, you know, we were a little bit looser up there. So like when I went to high school and the kids wore tank tops and short shorts or whatever, and then you knew when you went to the temple you had to wear full clothes. And it seems like all over Mormondom now it's changed. And the really sick part is there is an effort. I do not make this up. There is an effort among Mormons to make sure that infants have their shoulders covered. You know, like, this must make porn easier for them. You know, because some of us jaded, crack whorish sort of porn consumers have to really search hard to find things that get us off. But if all it takes is shoulders, wow, you got it easy. Like you don't even have to turn on like private browsing or anything. So, and of course, in typical misogynistic fashion, some. But he opened up the yearbook and found that there were plenty of pictures of boys without shirts on and with tank tops on that had not been altered. The real story here is the Mormons are kind of obsessed with shoulders. It has become the shibboleth of Mormondom in the state of Utah, whether or not you cover your shoulders. And it's really fascinating to watch, and I don't mean to belittle this at all, but a lot of women, when they leave the church, really struggle with this. And, you know, it's like they want to wear sleeveless clothing, but then the family reunion's coming up, and am I going to be labeled the woman in red, this, you know, the scarlet whore if I wear the sleeveless? And it becomes this big sort of thing. And then if you go anywhere else, like, nobody cares. But it is a big thing in Utah.
It is, and I thought it was interesting. And they
Hillary's not wearing sleeves.
I'm not. My porn shoulders are showing. I'm walking porn today. The ones that they picked and chose to cover, because, you know, I had that picture where there were the two girls wearing very similar, like, denim cutoff jacket type things. One of them was edited and one of them wasn't. So it was
It might be kind of like Lindsay editing the fucks out of my podcast.
She
just missed some.
All of the original outfits that these girls were wearing were all fulfilling the school standards for dress code. It wasn't like there was some ridiculously low-cut shirt or some, you know, spaghetti tank top straps. I mean, they were all
my daughter
calls it three fingers. My strap has to be three fingers wide. And they were all, you know, within the dress code of the school, just not the dress code of Mormonism.
Yeah, and it all felt really arbitrary and kind of like that they threw it in with small print on the, because they even said that everyone was informed about this policy before they took the pictures, and you're informing 15-year-old children about this policy in fine print. I mean, come on.
It's just weird. And this is one of the problems of religion. It's like closing the pools down on Sunday, you know, and I don't have any problem with people wanting to live the way they want to live and dress the way they want to live, but why do you have to enforce it on everybody else? And just sort of, listen, guys, just take a deep breath and realize that you got to live in the world. And the church is always 30 years behind anyway. I have heard rumors that the authorized pattern of the garment's been changed again. I'll have to search it out. Anybody have a? I'll have to get Mike Norton in here with a fraudulent temple recommend, so I can go buy some garments. Oh yes, that's it. The women now have cup sizes in there, which is about time. You want to know here's proof that it's a patriarchal church. the women's, yeah. Anyway,
same.
So good. Yeah, good. All right. So moving on. Otterson. What's Otterson's first name?
Michael,
that's right. Michael Otterson. The fascinating thing about this is he wrote a letter himself to all the ne'er-do-wells and dissident women out there. He's the spokesman in chief for the church. And I've made fun of this before, that the church has a new mantra. It's not, I know the church is true. It's, I'm not speaking for the church. Even when you're like the highest authorities, what the interesting story here is you have the chief spokesman for the church under his signatory line in the letter, putting his credentials, but he's saying, I. Can somebody down there grow a pair of balls and just take a stand on something? They want such plausible deniability everywhere that it's just...
They need a fall guy if something backfires.
So the funny thing, the article, of course, the letter, of course, is very patronizing. It's very smug. It's just what you would expect coming out of the church. And there's a great line from it, I quote, that he wants less cynicism and criticism, more respectful dialogue, more kindness and civility, and more generosity of spirit. As these members who are... See how I even take on the... I can't help it. These members who are prone to use the internet engage with each other. Prone to use the internet. Like it's a, yeah.
It's a predisposition.
Yeah, they were born that way. So less cynicism and respectful dialogue. Look, when you're walking around insisting the church is the one and only true church, there's no such thing as respectful dialogue. And they're making that clear. They're making it clear there's no space for dialogue here. And they're setting up straw men, women's organizations. We talked about this last week. So they can dialogue with the people who are already going to, you know, it's the loyal opposition who's, these kangaroo courts, they're just people who are put in place to rubber stamp what they already have. If they want meaningful dialogue, they have to listen, and they're not ready to listen, and you can see that in the article. So don't say meaningful dialogue at the same time you're writing this patronizing pile of shit that no one's going to listen to. Can the church PR department hire a PR department? Is that allowed? Because it seems like interns coming out of undergraduate programs say, oh, no, don't do that. That's a bad move. All right. Those are my news stories. Any other thoughts on Otterson? I'm sure he's a nice guy.
Mormon Expression is a listener-funded program. If you like what you hear, please visit us at mormonexpression.com and consider becoming a subscribing member. While you're there, let us know what you think about the show.
Okay. Tonight, we're trying something a little bit new. I was telling the studio audience before that I sometimes get tired of just poking holes in the same silly things in the church sometimes. And I was I was on vacation a little while ago talking to a great friend as we strolled around the streets. We were talking about what can we talk about in Mormon Expression? And we thought maybe it's time to bring the discourse level up a little bit. So I'm starting the Verses series, which is we're going to take great thinkers, great philosophers, great philosophies out there and compare them to Mormonism, talk about the influence they have on Mormonism, if any, and then how Mormonism stands up against some of these ideas from out there. So today we're going to start at the beginning. We're going to start with Plato. In the next few weeks and months, we're going to talk about Voltaire, Aristotle, Marx, and St. Augustine. And then if there's others that you all want to bring into the mix, then we can. I've mentioned many times in interviews and things that when I was leaving the church, I first started reading a lot of church history and found it was really weird. And I got the historical basis of my faith kicked out from underneath me. I took a deep breath and said, well, I need to really understand what's going on here. So I got two books. One of them was a history of the church, the Christian church, and to read, you know, what had happened over the last 2,000 years. And then I got a systematic theology to explain Christian theology to me. And I considered myself a pretty well-read guy. I enjoyed religion. I enjoyed reading everything I could get from the church. I was flabbergasted how ignorant I was, that these discussions had been going on for thousands of years, and these questions had been reviewed over and over and looked at from every angle, had been well understood by the academics. And we were sitting here smug in Salt Lake City pretending we knew the answers, going out into the world, and we didn't even know what the fucking questions were. And I was amazed at how ignorant I was. And we'll talk about some of this tonight. I mean, Adam, you've probably seen this. When Mormons try to talk authoritatively about things that other people really understand, and we sometimes come off looking like doofuses. And so if we can be a little less doofish... That's my goal.
That would be grand.
Yes. Now, your undergraduate degree was in philosophy.
It was.
And where did you study?
So I started, my wife was active duty in the Air Force, and I started in Central Texas College connected to Fort Hood, Texas. And that's where I fell in love with philosophy and was introduced to Plato for the very first time. And I finished up at Weber State. So shout out to Dr. Fudge and Dr. Green.
Excellent.
Great guys.
You know, I when I first got off my mission, I was a BYU student, and I didn't have enough money to go back to BYU. I had to work and save some money, so I went to Weber State. The BYU is a big school, and it's very competitive, and so you're in classes with 500 other students, and it's all about getting into business school and med school and law school, so very competitive on a grade point. I went to Weber, and the expectations were a little lower. So that when you showed a little bit of acumen, like the professors got really excited and they would spend some time with you. So sometimes there's something to be said for not going to like the best school in the state or the most competitive, because sometimes the professors like to talk to somebody who's not, well, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, no, case in point, I remember one time my professor up there, one of those that I just mentioned, calls me in front of the class and felt like I was in second grade again, recognizing me for this fantastic paper that I've written, and I'm just stressing about it, thinking it was the worst thing I've ever written. And if any of you ever want any advice from someone in this class about how to write a paper, go see Adam. And
I'll tell you how I cheated in a philosophy class at Weber State once. The guy who was teaching the class was kind of, he was getting up there in age, and the assignment was to write every week you had to write a summary of whatever it was we were doing. There's a question, you had to write a summary. And he wanted you to be very succinct. So you had to have it was a quarter page. Everybody else had Courier fixed fonts, but my computer didn't. So I was getting an extra 45 words in my quarter page, so I got good marks. All right, moving on. Tip for you kids. Moving on.
By writing more.
I cheated by writing more. Yeah, yeah, indeed. Okay. So tonight we're going to talk about Plato. And when we talk about Plato, we're really talking about Socrates also. So Plato was around circa 420, 427 BC is usually the year they give. Socrates, Plato wrote a series of dialogues, and then he wrote The Republic. And in all of his dialogues, the hero of the dialogue is Socrates, who is his mentor. And the problem is Socrates didn't write anything. So it's really impossible for us to separate Plato from Socrates. So Socrates is sort of the hero of the stories, but philosophers generally tend to reference Plato because that's who we're going. And we can actually see there's a lot of historical elements where they try to line up the different dialogues and see the evolution of Plato's thinking. But for our purposes, when we're talking Plato, we're talking Socrates at the same time. So we're really talking about, we're in Athens about 400 years before the birth of Christ. So at the time, the Socrates was kind of just a hippie.
Yeah, for lack of a better term.
He just kind of hung around, and he would collect these students, adherents, who would hang around him, who were usually the sons of aristocracy, and they would sit at his feet and listen to him pontify, and that was sort of how they'd hang out at the porch. What was the name? Do you remember the name of the...
The Acropolis?
Yes, the Acropolis, and then they would argue all these questions. Now, the form of the dialogues are in what's called the dialectic, and it's usually the dialogues are in this form where Socrates is asking people leading and baited questions. You know, they seem sort of trite now when we read them. You know, because you see people walking into a trap, and of course the people that Socrates is are talking to have Greek names that are actually kind of code names for their personality. So it's likely that these are sort of fictional or at least amalgamations of characters.
More than likely.
And so it's hard to know how much of this is the gospel truth. But as we get more writing, you know, from Aristotle and from others who reference this, it's pretty clear that these were real people and real schools of thought, and not just sort of, you know, people like, say, Abraham and Moses, where it's more likely these are stories that have been passed down generation after generation after generation. The philosophy of Socrates and Plato is pretty well established.
Agreed.
Okay. So that's sort of an introduction. So let's review Plato's philosophy. The dialogues usually happen with Socrates trying to pin somebody down. So somebody makes some ignoramus overarching statement about something about justice or love or mathematics or beauty, and then Socrates, well, let's get into it. Let's really define out what beauty is. And for Plato, he believes in what are called the forms. Now, when I'm looking at a chair right there, I recognize that's a chair. I might go home to the Velvet Lounge where I live, and there's this red velvet sort of plush chair with my smoking jacket draped seductively over it and my pipe. And I also recognize that's a chair, right? Then I go over to Hillary's IKEA chic apartment, and she's got this yellow sort of banana-looking thing. And we also would call that a chair. Now, for Plato, Plato would say we recognize them all because they partake of or emulate this form of a chair. That there's this concept of a chair that's out there somewhere, and you're recognizing it in these different objects. But chairness, or the form of the chair, has an existence outside of that chair.
He also, he refers to these forms as the idea, a capital I idea. And these ideas exist outside of us. They exist in some other realm. And yes, that these things that we see here, these particular versions of these things we see here, are a representation of those eternal forms or those ideas.
Now, these are disembodied, and they're real for Plato. But that doesn't mean they exist in space. Now, Platonism still exists in some forms, and it's usually in mathematical philosophy today. I'll give you an example that I'll tell you all that you all believe in this to some extent. If we talk about the number three, if you say the number three exists, I don't believe it exists, but most people do. They would say the number three exists, but does it have space? Does it live anywhere? Can you find three? No. What you're seeing is you're seeing an instantiation. Is that the right word? Sounds good. An instantiation of three. I see three chairs in front of me, so I have that concept of three. And what Plato would say is that, yeah, you're seeing the form of three in those three chairs or in these three people over here. But three itself, for Plato, exists as this concept that will survive us. It existed before we ever thought of it. It'll exist after we ever thought of it. And it is a real thing out there in the universe. For Plato, three is a real thing.
So in philosophy, this is a great example, John. What you're referring to is a priori items, if you are,
yes.
Things. So these are things that exist prior to us perceiving them.
Yeah, and that's going to be an important concept we're going to come back to when we start talking about Mormonism a little bit. Yeah, these a priori ideas, I think it's in the Crito. I didn't look it up. In one of the dialogues, Socrates walks a slave boy through doing a geometric proof. And he says, there's no way this slave could have come up with this advanced geometry. And Plato uses it as an example, saying he clearly was tapping into some other knowledge. It wasn't a creative process on the part of this slave. So for Plato, the fact that you recognize that as a chair wasn't from any learning. It was because you're connecting somehow with these forms that are out there.
Certainly. And obviously, I don't want to lead too much, but you can poke holes in that by showing how there's no way that this same slave boy would have known the particulars of what happened in Spartan Wars at the same time. And we can only go so far with that a priori information.
Agreed. Somebody needs to obey his own rules. All right. So another thing that's important here, And this is a concept that really is introduced by Plato. Is for Plato, the ideal state of being was to sort of merge unobstructed with these forms. And for Plato, our bodies were part of this imperfect world. So the chair that I'm looking at is an imperfect copy of this form, that we can't really get to those forms. They're perfect, they're beautiful, they're ephemeral, they're untouchable. And in this mortal world, we're surrounded by this coarse matter, this coarse material, and our bodies, which interfere with our connecting to those forms. And if you'll remember in the at the after Socrates had been condemned to death, he tells one of his disciples to sacrifice the idea is that I can't remember exactly, but when you, to one of the gods, you make a sacrifice when you're healed from being sick. And his idea was that being stuck in this mortal flesh is sort of a sickness because we are unable to connect to the beautiful. And for Plato, there's all these capital letters: the beautiful, the righteous, the just. These are all these concepts that are pure, that we can only try to copy here on this earth, but we never quite get to because this earth is distorted. So there's two fundamental ideas that Plato introduces philosophically. One is one of the first instantiations of the mind-body dualism, that who Socrates is different than Socrates' body. And it's important because this concept does not appear in the Bible at all. It's not there. We'll talk about this a little bit more, but this comes from Greek philosophy. And two, the idea that this world is a corrupt sort of evil place, and really you only get freed from it when you die and move on to this better, beautiful merging with the forms. These are both original ideas to Plato. So, Those were some of the key elements. Now, so we've talked about the dualism and heaven as an ideal state. What happens is Christianity, you can see this in the Bible, in the second half of the Bible, it begins, you know, with the Jews, but then it quickly moves out into Greece and into Rome. And we have the writings of some of the first apologists. The first apologist is Justin Martyr, circa 100 AD. And he gives nod to Plato. I think the quote is, spoke well in proportion to the share he had of the spermatic world, which is sort of the same thing that Mormons say. You know, they were doing as well as they could without having the gospel. So Justin Martyr was saying the same thing. He's saying, oh, look at this Greek philosophy that we have. They were really doing great things, but only in as much as they had, you know, knowledge. They didn't really have the true gospel. And then Clement of Alexandria, circa about 150, was a real strong Platonist. And there's another school of thought, and we're not going to get into all the details, but they start believing that the gospel sort of came through two avenues. One came through the Greek philosophy, especially from the Platonists. And in the future, in a couple months, we'll talk about the Aristotelians and how that gets impacted. But so these philosophical chains, particularly these ideas of the mind-body dualism and the earth as a corrupt place and heaven as an ideal place, really came from this Platonic Greek thinking. And then, of course, the coffin was sealed with Augustine. And he was a real firm Platonist and brought all this idea of heaven and that in. So the ideas we have of heaven, of the dualism, of the corrupted earth, really don't have any source in Hebrew philosophy. They all came from the Greeks. So when we look at the Book of Mormon from a critical perspective, this is one of those things, you know, I've said this on the podcast many times, but people who understand Christian philosophy look at the Book of Mormon and say, oh, it's patently ridiculous. And this is one of those reasons, because it is full-on post-Augustine Christianity, and the idea that this Jewish prophet in 600 AD, basically, you're talking about almost 1,000 years before Augustine, had a fully developed Augustinian view that came through these apologists is just crazy. It just doesn't make any sense. But it makes perfect sense if you realize that there's no way for Joseph Smith, just reading the Bible and hearing these other things coming from the pastors he would have been listening to, he wouldn't have been able to tease out those ideas at all.
Yeah, I mean, clearly when you read through this stuff and then you go back and you look at, maybe you've been introduced to philosophy at some point in your life and then you see the world through new eyes, you can't help but see the synergy between the two, that clearly Mormonism was influenced by this stuff.
Christianity, and yeah, all of Christianity, this is where you can see Mormonism coming straight out of Christianity. And the problem is this idea of this restoration. Now, what a cornered apologist like a badger would say to you is that, well, these ideas keep the gospel keeps getting restored and then lost and restored and then lost. So when you see these things come up, it's because somewhere along the line there was, I've actually heard this, that if you went back into the obscurity history, you'd find the Greeks at one time had the gospel, then they fell into apostasy. And it's very similar to what the early apologists were saying. I mean, the apologists have been doing the same tricks for 2,000 years. Like, it's not that far from Justin Martyr, you know, to be saying these things. But it's hard to underestimate, and you can see it in the architecture, you can see it in the churches, you can see it in everything, how much Greek philosophy really influenced Christianity and then where Mormonism came from that. So let's talk about some of the particulars of where Platonism and Mormonism line up very well. Joseph Smith was very much a Platonist. Now, When just to give a nod to Aristotle today, so I was talking about for Plato, the form of the chair exists out there in the universe somewhere, and then we copy it because we have this a priori knowledge. So a carpenter kind of accesses that bizarre back mind view of a chair, and he tries to create one. And for Aristotle, he would say, no, you see Hillary's crazy banana chair and my sophisticated red velvet chair and the chair in the studio, and then you start abstracting an idea of a chair. You say, oh, these are things I put my rear end on and I relax and smoke my pipe on. They must be a chair. So when you see something else that looks like it, then you say that's a chair. So that's more of an Aristotelian way of looking at things, that we abstract those ideas from the world that we're surrounded in. Aristotelian philosophy takes over probably in the medieval period, around about 1300.
1300, yeah.
But up until then, the church was very much Platonic. And so those early writings are very Platonic and Neoplatonism. So for Mormonism, first of all, the idea of the pre-existence resonates very much with Mormons. So when you get Plato and you start talking about these ideas that exist in people's heads, this is something that's very Mormon, because I was contemplating this over the last week. Mormons believe in a kind of a partial veil, right? They believe that there's a veil that keeps you from remembering the pre-existence. But when a child, for example, shows a lot of talent on the piano, most Mormons will say that that's because that they were remembering or recalling something from the pre-existence, that some of that bleeds through, right? I'm not making this up.
No.
So the idea, and I even remember when I was reading Plato the first time, yeah, because I was still a believer, and that resonated a lot with me. These a priori ideas made sense to me because we had existed before our birth, right?
Right.
So for Mormons to jump on that Platonic idea of pre-existence is a very strong resonance for them. And you see this come out in a lot of, the next thing that Mormons really resonate is with the idea of the forms. This is really underlying a lot of things in Mormonism. I'll give you three examples: eternal family, eternal marriage, and the eternal nature of gender. So people, like critics, start criticizing Mormons. Let's take the last one first, on gender. They say, what the fuck are you talking about? There's people who are born hermaphroditic. There's people who are born with all sorts of different... The genders are not a definable characteristic. You can find people who are... I can't even remember the name of the condition, but when we develop in the womb, we're all basically physiologically female until there's a hormone surge that comes, I think, in like 6 months, right in the second trimester. Is it earlier? But there has to be this hormone surge that happens to the body. There is a genetic disorder where that does not occur, and these are XY who are physiologically present as women. So what gender are they? That becomes a really tricky question, you know, because they'll have a vagina, but they're genetically men. But for a Mormon, we're talking about the form of gender. We're talking about this idealized state of gender. And when you start pushing these little details at them, you're trying to take an Aristotelian approach to a Platonic problem. And they would say, well, when everything is restored, when everything is the way it should be, that's when we get the idealized gender. So you can't pay attention to what's going on in this corrupt world, because for them, that's what's ideal.
It will all make sense when we die.
It all makes sense when we die. And it's the exact same thing that Plato would have said, because we don't have access to the forms when we're here. The world is corrupt. It's messy. And just like a couple weeks ago I talked about in the Grand Demonic Conspiracy, it's not just this corrupt world, but you have these nefarious agents around trying to throw smoke in your eyes all the time, and which very much resonates with Plato, because this world is a corrupt place and you can't get to what the idealized forms are.
Yeah, and I mean, this stuff, it all really works when you're operating from a position of privilege. But the second that you're out on the fringe in any way, it just all falls apart.
Absolutely. And that goes with the other two I brought up, eternal family and eternal marriage. You know, eternal marriage sounds great when your marriage is great.
Yeah, I never had anyone respond well to me about that on my mission. It was always, the question was, why would I want that?
Right, as young missionary, you were just thinking about boinking for the rest of eternity. Like, that sounds like a great idea to me. And then you get these middle-aged couples. You're like, mm.
Yeah, you have your first argument or your first conversationless dinner at Chuckarama, and you see why you wouldn't want that.
But, you know, you can push holes in it and saying, well, what are they doing? You know, because families are forever, right? And what do we do on family night? We play Life, and we play Trivial Pursuit. Is that what God does on Monday nights? He goes and finds his brothers in like the other universes, and they hang out and play Parcheesi and have brownies? I mean, maybe that's why there's so much war and famine in this world, because he's got to have family relationships. Well, what we're doing is we're bringing it down in the messy world again. That for Mormons, this is the form of marriage. It's the form of family, and the particulars of it don't matter. We're just extracting this concept of this idealized, beautiful family and throwing it up in beautiful heaven with the forms, with beauty and with justice and with all of these things that the Platonists would say exist. And for the Mormons, they exist also.
You know, and John, I think this is... I actually think that this disassimilation is one of the most painful things for people when your religious views start to fall apart. It's when you decide to live in the world of particulars and universals no longer apply. I mean, everything was so comfortable when I can just rely on the comfort of the universals. But when you no longer have that and you have to live here and now in particulars, life's just a whole lot different.
Well, I think you have an excellent point, because that's what makes this philosophy so appealing and why it keeps coming back. Because I'm almost making it sound ridiculous, but the idea that I can dismiss how imperfect the world is and how imperfect it is around me and know that there's something better. You know, when we talk about beauty with a capital B and we talk about justice with a capital J, I doubt there's not one of you who doesn't do that like once a week in some form or the other. Talk about this abstraction of this concept as if it exists out there, as if it's somehow waiting for us. Happiness. We talk about happiness all the time as if it's this thing that can be defined, as if it exists. But just like I'm telling you, the number three doesn't exist. Now, I need to get all my mathematical philosopher friends in here and argue this out with me. But it's not there. It's not there in the universe. And I would say it exists by definition, because we've claimed it. We've made it, we've just defined it into existence. It's useful. But to think that it's there can sometimes lead us astray and have us pursuing these things endlessly. And you see that pursuit of the forms in Mormonism, that pursuit of happiness, as if they're going to catch it, as if it's a state of being that is not extracted from all these different things. Because I think our Aristotelian friends would say, you feel this here, and you feel this here, and you feel this here, and you call all those happiness, and now you're taking them and abstract them into a state. But once you've done that, that thing may not actually exist. And when you look and say, the Smiths have a wonderful family, and the Johnsons have a wonderful family, and so from that we can extract this concept of familiness, of familitude. And that's what I want. We want to get to that. And you know, why is the kitchen dirty? Because we're not getting the form of family, that perfect idealized family. And I think in that way it can be a very dangerous idea because you're pursuing something that, in my view, doesn't exist.
I think there's a big romanticization of the pre-existence too. I think you reach for what you think you've kind of been promised. I just think of that, or like the familiar something. If you sense it's familiar, you would think that it's because it was meant to happen because it was part of the pre-existence. And I think of that song from Saturday's Warrior. I've seen this. I've seen your smile somewhere before, and you search for that because it gives you that sense of happiness and that sense of purpose.
Yeah, that it's this thing that's supposed to happen.
Yes,
and for the Platonic Christians, the early Christians, and then for the Mormons, heaven become, and they'll get angry with you if you try to make them define heaven. Heaven is this merging with these idealized states. And of course, that falls apart as soon as you try to put it into particulars. And they would say this. They would say, "What you're trying to define something into concreteness that's not concrete." That for them, going to heaven is merging with these forms, merging with these concepts of beauty and justice and love. And if you try to put it into forms we can understand here on this planet, you're messing them up. You're not grasping them.
Yeah, you're not playing the game anymore.
Yeah, yeah. So for Mormons, and this is one of the mistakes that those of us who try to persuade church members that their philosophy is ridiculous, we trip on, because we're trying to take those forms that they have, these abstractions, and say, see, it's doesn't work in the real world. But they would say, well, that's your mistake. You're trying to put them in the real world. They don't exist in the real world. This real world is corrupt. It's a copy of the world we used to live in. It's not the place that we're going. It's not the state we're going to be in. And you're misunderstanding, which leads us to the cave.
Lead in.
Go ahead. So, the cave. One of the most famous allegories that Plato has come up with is the cave. And I am guilty of this. Just as a disclaimer, anything I ever accuse an ex-Mormon of doing on this podcast, I have done, without exception. The cave is this brilliant sort of allegory, but we all of us secularists get it dead wrong. And Plato would call us to the carpet for it. The allegory of the cave is that there are a group of people who are chained to a cave. And they're inside this cave, and it's dark and dim. And all they can see is the inside wall of the cave. And they've been there their whole life. They've never seen anything else. Behind them is a fire. And there are some people who have puppets who are playing in front of the fire, and they're casting shadows. They can hear the noise, you know, bouncing off the cave, and they can see the shadowy puppets dance around on the cave. And to them, that's reality. In the allegory of the cave, one of them breaks free. Do you remember how he breaks free?
I don't think that it spells it out. It's just kind of just a spontaneous thing, just turning around and recognizing his shackles for the very first time.
So this individual...
Excuse me.
Yeah, yeah. He or she climbs out of the cave and first is presented by the light and can't see, blinded by this outside real world. But then I believe in the allegory it's a man, so once he gets... acclimated, he looks around, he can see what's happening because he's no longer chained to the cave and looking at the inside of the cave. He can see the puppets and he can see the fire and he can see the shadows. And he goes to all of his fellow captives and says, wait a minute, you're looking at an illusion. You're not looking at reality. You're looking at a shadow cast of reality. Come with me and I'll show you. I'll show you what the reality is. I can break you free from these chains. You can get out from here and stop perceiving the world in this corrupt way. And of course, everybody else says, ah, fuck off. We're having fun watching the puppet show. So that's the algorithm. Did I leave anything out?
Yeah, no, I think there's some great details in there to note. And you know, the first one is that when the person removes themselves from their shackles and notices all of this new information for the first time, it's so unfamiliar that they can't even describe it. Right. They have no idea what's going on. All they know is that it's different than what they've been seeing. And then the second thing is that these individuals have been shackled so tightly to the wall that they can't turn left or right. So if they have been communicating with these people next to them, their vision is strictly focused straight ahead. So when this person comes back to talk to them, they're not going to even recognize that he may have previously been sitting right next to them. So it's all very strange for them too.
Absolutely. So we like this allegory, those of us who have left the church, because we like to pat ourselves on the back and feel like we've broken through the chains. But what Plato was trying to say is that the world we live in, the things that we see are corrupt. Plato is not an empiricist at all. And empiricism is the root of science, which was really built on Aristotelian philosophy. The idea that we can observe the world and then discern things. Plato would say the world's fucked up. You cannot believe your senses. You cannot believe what you're seeing because the forms themselves are the source of knowledge and the source of truth. And the forms themselves are not informing your eyes and your ears and your brain. That's all corrupt. This world is a degenerate place. And for Plato, like in the last dialogues of Socrates, the only way for Socrates to be free was to take the hemlock and to free himself from this mortal coil. So for Plato, he would say, if you want to draw conclusions about this world, you can't stare at the cave. And what is the cave wall? It's this world. So for Plato, those of us who leave the church and say, hey, look around us, look at science, look at watch Cosmos, the series, and you'll know. Plato would say that's all just shadows on the wall. That what's real is these forms out there. And who has access to the forms? People who have access to the forms are the guy who broke the chains. And what would a Mormon call the guy who broke the chains? Call him the prophet, right? The one that has been told about them, the one person that can come down. So for Mormonism and other Christian philosophies, you cannot believe what's going on around you. When you go to the museum and you see dinosaur bones, these are shadows on the wall of the cave. And only those who have been freed from empiricism in some sort of mystical sense, are the ones who can touch the... Now, Plato didn't really involve a lot of mysticism. I think there were probably cults or whatever that came after, but I don't think he was advocating very much that there's mystics who can touch the forms better. But we'll talk about that in a second. We talk about the Republic.
No, I don't think that he was, but I think he was certainly much more mystical in his worldview than Socrates or Aristotle. And it was heavily influenced by his childhood readings of like the Spartan Wars, and he was very heavily influenced by that. That there's this kind of how we are with Disney and things like that, you know?
Right. So I think it's important that the cave is a cool allegory, and Mumford and Sons did a nice song about it. And but you have to understand what Plato's really saying. And I think what's key for us, especially as we have left the church to try to communicate with people in the church, we see this and we see, oh, this is so apparent. If they can just hear the allegory of the cave, they will know they leave the church. But what I'm trying to tell you is you flip it 180 degrees and it works exactly the same. Mm-hmm. That they're going to see you as the one who's chained, and that you sort of breaking your chains from the church and starting to drink booze and kiss girls and stuff, you're going to be that's your chaining to the wall of the cave. And that's why we have to be careful about recasting the world in our own current view and saying, why isn't this obvious to everybody? Why can't everybody in the church see that this is obviously true? Because the allegory of the cave shows that we tend to ignore disconfirming evidence. And we think it's just bogus.
Well, John, you've pointed out this in a previous podcast about the smoking gun and how there is no smoking gun, and everyone basically just has a light switch, and it's for a number of reasons. It can be for a million things. And, you know, in the cave, it doesn't matter which situation you're talking about, but they do point out that, or Plato points out that if you try to go back into the cave, you're not going to be well received. In fact, they'll try and kill you for coming back in. So I think that's important to note here, that trying to go back in and trying to have these conversations, more than likely, most of the time, it's not going to be received very well. But people will unshackle themselves from whichever system they're in whenever it happens to happen.
Well, this is where I agree 100%. This is where I sort of buy more into the Zen philosophy of Buddhism. Of course, Buddhists are looking for an enlightenment. And in the Zen school, in some of the earlier schools, you know, like Theravada Buddhism, it would be this long slog of meditation and rightful living and right thinking, right-mindedness and right action and following the rules of the Sangha and all that kind of stuff. And then the Zen school sort of rejected that and say this is more of an instantaneous thing. When you reach enlightenment, it happens in a flash. And this is the idea of instant karma, of course, which John Lennon screwed up for all of us. The idea of instant karma and the Zen koans, you know, the idea that there's this thought pattern that's sort of incongruent that can immediately awaken us to the illusionary nature of existence. And I think that there's an element of that inside a faith change, be it conversion into a church or conversion out of a church. That's that light switch. Now, I personally believe that my worldview, which is based on empiricism and a certain degree of skepticism and logic and reason and evidence and all that kind of stuff, is a superior system, mostly because it's self-correcting. But there is a certain amount of putting my credulity into this system of belief and accepting that system sort of wholesale. And that kind of goes to that light switch. And you see it happen. You know, we tend to gravitate towards like this podcast community, people who reject it for some sort of skepticism. But it happens all the time that people hit their light switch and they switch from being a Mormon to a Methodist or a Mormon to a Hindu or a Hindu to a, you know, they flip these worldviews. That's why I think it's important to be very careful and very skeptical in your thinking, because I'm more of an Aristotelian, and we'll get into that more. I don't believe there's a form of a chair out there. I believe that we understand chairs by seeing them and abstracting the concept from there. So that's why I would fundamentally disagree with this concept of the cave. And the more I've thought about it, especially in preparation for this, the more I think it's kind of a weak analogy. We use it kind of in a way that makes us sound, because what we're really saying is, haha, we broke out of jail, you dicks, you're still stuck in there. It's sort of a pat on your back way of saying, hey, I know, I've seen what's outside the cave. But if you buy the analogy, it doesn't necessarily work. You just reverse it.
Yeah, and through studying to prepare for this, I kind of came to that same conclusion. I was interested that I think that this is one of the places where Plato pays the most homage to Socrates, because he's so much more mystical than Socrates, but he does hold true to his dialectic. So it's paying homage to that process of asking questions. I mean, the being unshackling yourself is an allusion to, hey, ask questions.
Yeah. Look around. I think so, and I think that's what we can say, because I've said many times, you know, my theory is that to leave religion is a two part. You have to have an emotional disconnection and an intellectual disconnection. If you have an emotional disconnection from the church, you don't like the church, but you believe it's going to be true, you're going to slog there. That describes 75% of the members, right? They don't like it, but they keep going because they believe it's true. There's another group who don't believe it's true, but they like it. These are the sort of John Delinians who say, I love being a Mormon, even though it's all bullshit. They keep going because they have that emotional connection, right? And then, of course, the ones that have both, they're the zealots. They love it. And then the ones that that don't have either one, then those are the ones who leave. And I'm overgeneralizing, but this is usually true. What oftentimes happens is you don't like church, and then you discover something historically, and that kicks you out. But I think you generally have to have both of those things to make the leap, because the leap is a hard leap to make, and it involves a lot of work and a lot of pain.
Amen.
Okay, so let's talk about the Republic. This was sort of Plato's seminal work. He wrote a lot of the, I think most scholars agree this was his, he wrote this after most of the dialogues. And he's tackling some of the problems. We don't have time to go into everything. He has some ideas that are really interesting today and that still play out. And one of them is this progression of governments that you'll go from a democracy to having an emperor and then having a, you know, and then so he walks through some of these things that happen over and over again in history. And he's really meditating on some of the problems. So Athens had a democracy that became corrupt and then sort of collapsed. And then Rome had a democracy that became corrupt and sort of collapsed. And then the question is, are we doing the same thing today? Because one thing he predicts in the Republic is that there'll be further and further and further concentration of power. And we're seeing the same sort of things happening, even unwittingly. Like, everybody talks, for example, as if the president controls the budget. Everybody does. Every news story. This drives me absolutely mad. The president does not have any power over the budget. But the guys in Congress who control the budget, who are in the opposing party, will talk as if the president controls the budget. So rhetorically, they're giving this power, this concentration of power. One of the key ideas in the Republic is as Plato is trying to solve this problem of power, of who do you allow to govern. He comes up with this plan that you take the elite when they're young, and you sort of almost monasticize them. He takes them out of society, right? And he starts training them up separately and training them in science. And he has a method, like they learn, I can't remember what they learn first, they learn second. But the idea is they learn all of this stuff, and they kind of become this holy order of people who have been proven again and again and again. And one of the things they've been done is they've been disciplined to avoid monetary corruption. They're outside the monetary system, and they're beyond corruption, and they've been specially bred to be leaders. And then what Plato ultimately wants is what he calls the philosopher king. He says the only kind of government that's really going to work is a despotic government. We have one person or one group of people who control a lot of power. Because as Plato points out, democracies enable stupid people. Does he say that in the Republic?
Well, I doubt he says it just like that. But he's against, what's the word for it? Not aleatory, but... Yeah, we're just a government where everyone has equal say because we don't have equal capacity, if you will.
Right, right. If you give everybody, and we see this all the time, the people, look at the proposition laws that were changed in California 15 or 20 years ago. It's becoming a big problem in California because they pass all these ignoramus laws because the people want them. Oh, that sounds good. Yeah, but they don't have to fund them. They don't have to enforce them. They don't have to look after these laws. So they're getting buried under this. And this is what Plato would point out as the problem with democracy, is you let people vote these laws in. They don't necessarily have responsibility for what those laws mean. And so Plato is trying to solve that problem and get that ultimate philosopher king who understands everything, and to touch his older philosophy, that philosopher would really have better understanding of the forms. Through his education, the philosopher king would have a better understanding of the concept of justice than the regular person would have. So he would be more likely to be able to implement justice. But his rules might seem arbitrary, capricious, or downright mean to the common people because they would not have the same level of understanding or be in touch with the forms or the idealization that this philosopher king would know. What I think is fascinating is to compare this to the system that was put in place by Joseph and then Brigham, where what you have here is this long schooling that starts when men are very young, usually between 30 and 40 is when they, that's very young to me now. Between 30 and 40 when they'll start serving their first, they'll become the bishop or they'll have been in the high council. And then they'll serve 5 or 10 years as a counselor to the stake president, 10 years as a stake president. Then they'll serve as a mission president. They'll serve in an area authority. And they'll have been groomed for 30 years at least generally. And in this whole time, they're being schooled in this philosophy and they're being removed from the regular commerce system. Now, general authorities get paid. Let's be clear. But there's a couple of things that the church has done amazingly well when you look at the history of organizations. They've eliminated basically the two areas of corruption that bring down governments. One is sex and the other is money. And the church authority has had their sex scandals and has had their money scandals, but not nearly as often as other organizations. They've done an amazing job of basically breeding this class of leaders to be in those positions. This is why I push back when people, a lot of ex-Mormons, when they're fresh out, say, oh, they have to know it's not true. They have to know it's not true. How can they be there and see all that? Because they've been bred for that for 60 years by the time they get into that position. And that sort of thought in my mind doesn't even cross their minds. They have been systematically selected and weeded to be in these positions of leadership. And from an organizational perspective, it's fabulously brilliant. You don't give men any power until they're basically impotent. How many men have been brought down by, you put a man in authority and he's going to fuck around? I mean, that's like a universal rule. So you wait until it's just not interested.
Yeah, and you're digging into it deeper, John. But, you know, in fairness to a true believing Mormon or someone that's true believing in any other faith, they would use that as something that's a proof that these men are above all of these things, though, too. Like, our leaders aren't tempted by these things, or they are, and they rise above them. And it's just one more thing to show that we can trust these men.
Absolutely. And my point is that the way Plato looks at his philosopher kings is a lot of the ways that the Mormons look at their leaders, that these are men who are in touch with this heavenly guidance. Even if they're not having Jesus whispering in their ear, they are more spiritually in tune and better able to recognize these things than you and I are. They're more in touch with these forms. They're more in touch with what is heavenly. And they're oftentimes the true order of governance, the true order of priesthood. And when you start saying things like true order, man, you're right back there in Platonic forms again.
When they start them all earlier now with the lowering of the missionary age, they're getting younger and younger at the time they can start to breed them into that perfect philosopher king that they want them to be.
Yeah, the longer they can keep the leadership out of touch with the world, and we've talked about this in terms of time commitment, once you get into a bishopric, stake presidency, your hobbies are pretty well done. I mean, you're spending 20, 30, 40 hours a week outside your regular job being schooled in this and taken out of the things that might distract you from this. I've quoted him many, many times, but Bob McHugh famously said, you know, if I'd never been released as bishop and had some time to think, I probably would have never been able to get out of the church. It was only when I had a few weeks to breathe and sort of process this stuff that I started saying, wait a minute, because you just keep going down this path and down this path. Now, for Socrates, for Plato, this was the right thing because they're getting schooled in all the areas they need to learn. But that's what's happening with the Quorum of the Twelve. Look at you have accountants and you have lawyers and you have businessmen, and this is the skill set they need to run this church in this day, and that's what they're being bred for.
Yeah, and you know I've mentioned a couple times already, but I brought up Sparta and in researching for this, I was so fascinated to find out how heavily influenced Plato was by Sparta, and you see in this ideal state, in this city state, that it really does mirror the Spartan way. They were taken from their homes when they were just 7 years old. They were tossed in a pit if they weren't fit as a baby. And then they were trained until they were 30 years old, segregated from the opposite sex, just like we do. We go out on missions and we can't talk to the opposite sex, touch the opposite sex. We're very segregated. And then we pass through these different positions, and just like the Spartans would. And they eventually, one of them would become the Spartan king. There was two armies, and there was a king that would reign over each of them to keep the two of them in check. But I think the really interesting thing about this is the Spartan Empire fail. And the reason that it fell is because we know the mystical version of the Spartan story. But we fairly talk about the real version of the Spartan story. And you talked about being segregated from money in the ideal state, not having that draw, that appeal that money can bring. And these men were supposedly segregated from it, whereas the real history suggests, no, they were just as human as everybody else, and they were taking bribes all the time. I think the danger is if we, and I think a great thing that your podcast does, is if we focus too much on this mystical history, and we just don't recognize that there is a real history also, we can get in danger very quickly.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, one of the things about the church is the corporate church is really the most powerful thing. I mentioned before, the 12 and the 70 are in gilded cages. Because it's this way by design, because there's little chance for corruption for them. We force them to maintain their homes. Now they have nicer homes in the state of Utah. You know, they're living in $500,000 to $1 million homes, but they're not living in $50 million homes. And people post on Facebook all the time, oh, I saw Uchtdorf at the Costco buying pants. You know, so but this is the way the church wants it, right? They want these guys visible, and when you have a minder, a driver, a security guy around you, that works both ways, right? You got a minder around you, and it's kind of hard to ask the clerk for a copy of Hustler when you're buying your Diet Coke if you got your church security guy with you. So in a way, these guys are prisoners. And so where does the real power lie? It lies in this institution, and that's what's really scary. And that's what we see, you know, happened with Rome, is as these institutions of power became concentrated and corrupt, more so than the Senate and the individuals. But then what can happen, and I don't, when you have the church and state, it gets a little bit weird, because the Mormon church obviously doesn't have an army, which prevents it from doing, you know, like doing a coup or anything like that, which is good. Well, I'm all for that. Yeah. We don't need the Swiss Guard in Salt Lake City. So there are checks on that power, but I think it's fascinating, you see, that we don't give enough credit to, I think, how ingenious, if not bizarre and weird, how ingenious the system of the church is in terms of surviving today. Because there's a real sort of Darwinistic element that affects religions. Religions that, for example, decide that no one should have sex tend to die out, either because people go to the church across the corner or they stop reproducing. So there's some ideas in religion that are dead ends. So religions by there's this predatory natural force that sort of weeds them out. And the fact that the Mormon church has survived and thrived as long as it is makes it a fascinating study to say exactly why and how. And I think these parallels between some of the ideas that Plato had in the Republic about how to breed, the right sort of philosophers and be impervious to the outside force, and how these men, who are obviously very intelligent, how they cannot be influenced by ideas that were, I mean, we showed in the beginning of this podcast, right, that the church was proven wrong, like by Justin Martyr, you know, like 100 years after Christ. Like, it's the Book of Mormon is obviously not true because it has ideas that it couldn't have possibly had. They were time out of. So how is it that was Oaks the Supreme Court justice for Utah? Or was he just on the Supreme Court? He wasn't the Chief Justice. He was so Oaks, you know, obviously a very intelligent man. I'm a Holland. President of university, Oaks was president of university. These guys are really well put together. They're not slouches. How is it that they don't see, you know, like the stuff that Darwin wrote in 1860 deconstructed their faith? Well, because they've been very systematically walked down that path, and it's the cave again. You're the one who's not seeing things correctly. You're the one who's seeing the shadows. They're the ones who have true knowledge, and true knowledge supersedes any sort of empiricism that comes out. And the problem with the fossils is you dig them out of the earth, and the earth is corrupt. And so why would you trust anything that comes from the corrupt earth?
Yeah, and the There's a lot about the city-state that's really interesting and compelling. I mean, the thought of having someone pass through all these different stages of life so they would be maybe more empathetic towards the farmer and more empathetic towards the soldier and better understand what that person is going through so they can govern them. But this goes back to the problem with the universals versus particulars. When you have these people who eventually become these king philosophers, if you will, you're presupposing that they will have access to these universals when they get there. A couple of problems. What happens when they get there and they don't have access to them? And also, how are these universal people supposed to be dealing with people living in particulars?
And what if they don't exist at all? Yeah. And I kind of hinted to that problem, is you get the people at the top who have this supposed better mystic knowledge that no one else can check. There's no check and balance on them. There's no way to say, wait a minute, because the whole structure is set up so the prophet knows more than the rest of us, and no one can question what he's saying. And it's the same problem that's built into Plato's philosophy, which is why most people don't buy into it, is you get these philosopher kings, and they're unquestionable, and they have so much power. But Plato had such faith in philosophy that he thought philosophy would mitigate that. But 2,500 years has shown us not to put a lot of faith in that. So I think, kind of in summation, I think sometimes these ideas, I've said this before, but Mormons should be less ashamed of Mormon theology and sort of look at it as a new take on these old ideas. That a lot of these things, like the eternal family, are really fascinating when you put them in context from a philosophical view and saying, now we're looking at the form of a family, what does that mean? But the problem is the church is so literal on everything that they try to take Platonic ideas and Aristotelianize them. And it makes this weird sort of mishmush. And what they really need to do is sort of own their own ideas, and then they can look at them in the school of the world and see how they hold up. So I think comparing Plato to Mormonism, I think is quite fascinating, because Joseph Smith and Plato really had a similar view of the way things work.
Yeah. I mean, clearly he was heavily influenced by these ideas. I don't know, John, are you aware of him having access to Plato's writings in his home in Palmyra?
We know that he had a library card or something, didn't he? But, I mean, it's not like, we sometimes talk about him like he's on an island in like the fourth century or whatever. You know, this is after the Enlightenment, and after, so that there were a lot of newspapers around, and there was a library, and, we know Joseph Smith is part of a debating club, so the idea that he would be open to a lot of ideas is pretty clear. Joseph Smith, I believe, is very, very intelligent, of a high degree of intelligence, and I believe it's pretty clear he had a photographic or near photographic memory when it came to reading things. So the man was quite gifted, and he showed himself to be a magpie when it came to absorbing ideas. And these ideas, we didn't walk fully through this history. You can, as a homework assignment, you can go read about how Platonism weaves through the church and these ideas. But the idea that I gave you on heaven and hell and the corrupt earth, these are ideas that are still being pounded around in Christianity that are not biblically sourced. They come from the Greeks. So I think it's clear to see that just even talking to the itinerant preachers who'd be coming through town, he would have absorbed a lot of these ideas. All right. The quiz will be at the end of next Thursday. I promised a rant about philosophy professors, but I didn't. I didn't give one.
You're just chickening out. Come on, bring it. You tease that, and then okay, we're just going to wrap up.
The question is, why do I not have any? You've represented philosophical position, but I have access to philosophy professors. Why are there no philosophy professors on this panel? There's a great book out there called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, written by Robert Pirsig. Robert Pirsig takes a shot at philosophy professors quite often. And one of the things he says about philosophy professors is that hardly any of them practice philosophy. They all practice what he calls philosophology, which is the study of philosophy. Now, philosophy professors are notorious for claiming that all the branches of science are a subset of philosophy. I'm going to fire back and say philosophy as it exists in the universities is a branch of history. that philosophy professors really want you to know the school of thought. And they will start giving these long genealogies of whose idea came to this idea and came to this idea and this came to this idea. And I think the problem I have with it, and one of the reasons, oh, now I'm going to piss a lot of people off, but fuck them. One of the reasons I don't have a lot of PhDs on this podcast, especially ones that teach in school, is because they teach before students who have no right to challenge them. And a lot of professors are god-awful at rhetoric. And because the emperor's not wearing any clothes and they don't have to perform and they don't have to come before an audience and actually keep the audience listening. So that's my shot at philosophy professors. I think philosophy, some of these ideas are interesting. They're not that inaccessible, and people can understand them, but I think sometimes philosophy professors make their money by making ideas sound more obscure than they are.
Yeah, I think everything that you just said was fair, you know, but in fairness to some of the professors that I did have, I do think that if in any discipline, but if a professor sticks to the dialectic approach and treats the pupil as someone not that is being spoken to and talked to, but involves them in the process, I think any professor can be successful and is going to reap much better rewards than that person that just gets up and pontificates about any given subject.
Absolutely. And there's don't get me wrong, I'm exaggerating to make a point. But there's some really great professors out there, but I want you all to know that just like the theme of Mormon Expression, it's not you, it's them. That oftentimes when you were bored and getting a C in school, you know, sometimes it was the professor. Have you ever gone back, like especially after you've been out in the workforce, whatever, taken a class about something you knew about? Have you ever taken a college class on something, a topic you already knew about? Half the time you're like, this guy's full of shit. He doesn't know what he's talking about here. And he just confused me and I know this better than him. And so I think sometimes our higher education institution could use a little tweaking.
Fair.
Do y'all feel worn down by... you should read... Plato is really highly accessible and the dialogues are fairly short and they're really fascinating. You should all go out there and read a few of them. Some of them, they're really fun. The dialectic is a great way to approach. You'll be able to see through it somewhat, but they're entertaining and it's a great place to start.
Can I tell a fun story about Plato and Mormonism? So when we were living in Texas, my wife and I was just 2 years removed from my mission and still on fire. And we're working with the local elders there and we had this family and I'm ashamed to admit it, but I used the cave to get them baptized and they fully did. And on top of it, they were African American and they had two kids. And I just feel terrible every time I think back using the cave to get them to get baptized. And so elders, if you're out there and looking for a tool, it does work.
The cave.
And I got to tell you about a kind of a platonic scandal we had at BYU when I was there in the art department. We, you know, finding this ideal of beauty is obviously the age-old dilemma of an artist. Well, we had a professor who had a kind of obscure book. I don't even know if it was in print, and he had a couple copies that he'd carefully hand out, but it was called Sacred Geometry. And essentially the idea was that, you know, as Mormons, we're very literal, and that we can quantify beauty. We can get to this form that you're talking about. There is an ideal to everything. And so his whole point was that as you design paintings, you would use this very formal, almost Euclidean, simplified geometry. Uh-huh. So you started seeing these students that wanted to show that they were in on this kind of secret form, and they'd have a really shitty painting. But it has squares and grids and lines and, you know, somehow showing that they were in on this. And it was just crazy as we at the time began to really look closely at nature and how it's put together. You know, what philosophers said, you know, there's not a straight line in nature. This is kind of silly that we're trying to, back to the point, it's messy. There aren't straight lines. And then we start getting into this chaos theory and these fractals, these beautiful patterns that we're starting to say, that's the order, not this, you know, the square and the circle and all that stuff. So there was a real battle and you had these professors just calling each other, you know, idiots, and you'd have their little disciple groups. But for me, it came down to, why do we want to head to this ideal? I mean, it seems to me the messiness of life is what is beautiful about it. I don't think I'll ever meet another John Larson. I hope I don't. And for that reason,
well, me too.
And I say that in that it's a good thing. There's one John Larson that can do his thing only the way he does it. I think in the end, that's really what's beautiful. Why would we want to get to this other side? Will our forests be full of the ideal tree, the one? And it seems like we are even headed that way just with Godhood. If God is doing something perfect, how is there any variety?
Right.
As we keep heading, like you're saying, to this ultimate end, as an artist, you know, leave me in the mess. That's where I think we find our joy, you know, where we find true beauty. You know, they've done studies about beauty and the ideal face and the proportion. You've all seen them. If you're too perfect, you're just, yeah, you know, if you're truly that supermodel, there's something really kind of almost perverse about your look. I mean, it's just on the border where just one more, you know, dimension out of whack and you're really ugly. You're distorted. I think, you know, as they're studying life, you got to be right on that edge of chaos if it's too ordered. So for me, it just doesn't seem like it's a path you want to go down, you know, perfection. I mean, that to me is the smoking gun of all this. Do we really want to be perfected?
Yeah. Anyway. You know, and I think all this, I think it only, one of the things that we didn't talk about was the idea of immortality and how that's just, I mean, really laced into Platonic theory and all of this stuff just really breaks. And I worked in hospice for 3 years, end of life care. If any of my former patients, family members are listening, had fantastic patients and great families, wonderful experiences. But you see this in that type of care where the universals start to break down because you're right there at the end and you are in a very real way experiencing the particulars because life, it's winding down and you only have so much more time and you're keenly aware that you only have that time. I think that all of this stuff, we only have it because it gives us comfort if we believe in both of those two things. An immortal soul, immortality, and this universal thing that we will go on chasing for all time. When all that breaks down, it's not all that comforting anymore, though.
Yeah, the fascinating points you both bring up about that tension between chaos and order. And, you know, as you start talking about the Euclidean and the geometry, I'm, of course, taken back to masonry, you know, and which, of course, was a way to try to take... And there's been this constant theme through history of looking at mathematics, and it's the pure science and the order that we see in mathematics we want to apply to the rest of the world, even our search for like the universal constants and these elements of these equations that bring everything together. And you know, as we went through the Enlightenment and things became more chaotic as we started learning more, and when you really we oftentimes extract history from war. And the same period became very chaotic on the battlefield. You have guns starting to knock down gentry who used to be safe on their horses, and this chaotic element entering into society. The city-states are becoming stronger. The merchant class becoming stronger. The old social order has been all thrown on their head. And at the same time, you see the emergence of Freemasonry. And geometry is going to explain everything and start putting this order over heaven. You have the frontier then a few years later where Joseph Smith is. There's, the churches aren't around. The clergy's not around. And masonry starts spreading faster than the churches. And here Joseph Smith looks at this, trying to take this chaotic mess of all these religions and put order on it and restoration, the one true church. And they're all resting in abomination. And then he runs into masonry and this geometric order. The way you get into heaven is you have the secret password to pass by the angels, to stand as sentinels. It makes so much sense. It's so ordered, you know. And we've talked before about, we have a podcast loaded up at some point to talk about what it means through Mormon theology, the way we present the vision of Jesus. And I contend that Jesus at any given time is the idealization of masculinity. And you can see the stern Jesus from the 60s and 70s. Now we have the smiling Jesus. Then we have the laughing Jesus and the playing with kids Jesus. And it's going to be whatever we envision masculinity to be. And I think you can go back in time and see more effeminate or more powerful or these different things, because we're looking for these idealizations. We're looking for these forms because the world is a mess. And I think people like you and I can finally embrace that, knowing it's scary, it's chaotic, but there's something beautiful about that mess, but a lot of people don't like it. Mm-hmm. And they like to push back against it, and they like to weed the garden and plant tomatoes. All right. Any other thoughts on Plato?
Covered it.
Well, as always, you've wasted another hour or so here listening to the podcast. There's going to be a hell of a lot of the hours that you can wait. I hear people binging these days. I'm like, that must take a month, right? That's a long time. But it's been fun. Thanks to Randy, our intrepid producer of Mormon Expression, who's made a lot of what's happened lately possible. And thanks to you, Randy. And to our wonderful panel. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
And you can check us out on our website. You can see the future recording schedule, other events that are happening, or join us in our Facebook community and see what's going on the inside. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Expression is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Visit us online at whitefieldseducational.org to find more about our current initiatives. Mormon Expression is recorded live in downtown Salt Lake on Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. If you're in the area, please come join us in the studio.